Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The Air Force will spend its own money to fix up privately owned housing projects at two bases. Members of Congress, though, aren't exactly sold on the idea, even though decrepit housing has been an ongoing issue for the Air Force. Federal News Network's Anastasia Obis joins me with the latest details. Anastasia, why is the Air Force covering the cost of reinvestment, as they put it, into private housing and not the owners?
In 2025, the Air Force is requesting about $144 million for privatized family housing. Of course, the first question from lawmakers during last week's hearing was, why is the Air Force covering that bill and not the private companies themselves, given that they assumed the responsibility of those units? Ravi Chaudhry, he is the boss of Air Force Installations, says the oversight program the Air Force put in place to hold private companies accountable is bringing some positive results. He says the service is directly involved with the structures. They're not just giving away money. They're not giving a lump sum and just saying, do what you wish, but they have a lot of oversight over it. That way, he says, they will be able to tell if the improvements that they're investing in have direct impacts on military families. They do that both with the installation command and resident advocates they hired to be the voices of those families. Let's take a listen to Dr. Chaudhry on how he thinks about additional investments into privatized family housing.
I will say one thing. When we need to act on behalf of our military members and their quality of life, we will. So when that occurs on these restructures, we make sure that it goes directly to those housing units, and our oversight programs provide that visibility to include our resident advisors, resident advocates, who we've hired roughly 218 or so. We're going to continue that trend to make sure that that oversight maintains a level of awareness that allows us to hold these project owners accountable.
And how is the Air Force actually planning to make sure those companies are accountable for the overall quality of the housing?
This year, the service held a project owner at one of the Air Force installations accountable for about $58 million. That's to address mold issues in almost 1,000 units. Last year, the service held another project owner accountable for almost $32 million, and then another additional $33 million in 2024 to address some safety issues. Dr. Chaudhry mentioned in that clip that they hired over 200 what they call resident advisors to help service members resolve any housing issues along with their chain of command. But here's Ravi Chaudhry on what the Air Force is doing to hold those companies accountable.
What we've done is laid in an oversight program that we believe is getting us gains these days. We had a number of restructures last year. That number has gone down this year, and we expect that trend to continue. That's by providing significant oversight with accountability, oversight, and when we need to, enforcement.
Well, you have to have standards, I mean, and metrics to know what it is you're holding the housing owners accountable for, like zero mold or no broken windows. I don't know, there's probably 100 different metrics on a given apartment unit. So what are the metrics the Air Force is actually using here to make sure that they know what to oversee and can hold people to the fire?
Something that they put in place is if a contractor is not performing well, they put that contractor on a watch list. And being on a watch list, it puts the focus of the headquarters and the installation on that particular project manager. Then they get a notice on what it is that they need to improve upon. The biggest indicator is usually the feedback from the residents. Those on the watch list are enrolled in a program, and that's supposed to improve their performance. It gets at their performance incentive fee. So if they don't perform well, they get hit with penalties. Let's take a listen to Ravi Chaudhry again on how they evaluate how well contractors are performing.
Ultimately, if they fail in all three levels, we'll go back and go to a default situation. So that progressive approach, we believe, has been yielding some good impacts, especially with our newer project owners that are realizing that all they have to do is meet a certain standard and they'll get A grades. So some of the folks who have been around since 2005, they're slow to come along, but they're now starting to come along recognizing those gains.
Yeah, it's kind of a tough situation, Anastasia, because the housing operator owns the housing. It's not as if you can go somewhere else Your reporting is showing the Air Force is requesting more funding relatively for privatized housing than the other armed services. Why is that?
Yes, the Air Force currently has an outsized number of problems in comparison to other services. Dr. Chaudhry said they will look into what it is that other services are doing that's successful. But we have been hearing about issues with privatized military housing since 2018. It sounds currently like there actually has been a shift from privatized housing is just the worst thing that can happen to let's actually introduce a lot more privatized housing. Let's privatize barracks. And that's partially due to financial constraints. But the way lawmakers talk about solving the housing issue, the winds have definitely shifted towards a more positive outlook on privatized housing. The Air Force, for example, this year, they're investing over $1 billion into modernizing its barracks. Their first privatization project for barracks is going to take place in California this year, and other services are following the same model. So, I mean, the winds are definitely shifting.
Federal News Network's Anastasia Obis, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Be sure to check out her story at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. and even your title, Chief People Officer. What does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with an intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, Have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.